started. Borodar, good morning. I'm Auriel Miller. I'm the director of the IWA, and welcome to our latest online session looking at the media in Wales. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, and yes, there are some of you out there who are joining us for the first time, we are Wales's leading independent think tank with a long track record of shaping debates, influencing change in Wales through policy research and advocacy. Our online and print publications, here's the latest edition of the Welsh Agenda. We provide platforms for robust comment and debate and our agenda setting events. We're a membership organisation with members right across the country and much further afield. We're funded by our members, the events that we run ourselves, and independent trusts and foundations. Today's conversation is being held in partnership with the Media Reform Coalition as part of their engagement around the BBC and Beyond project, looking at the future of public service media across the UK. So I'm going to shortly hand over to Dr. Debs Grayson from the Coalition to chair us through today's conversation and to tell you a bit more about the project. First of all, though, a bit of housekeeping. This is a Zoom webinar, so you're, as participants, you're muted by the host, and we're going to use the Q&A section at the bottom of your screen for questions. If you'd like to direct your question to a particular panelist, please do state their name. We really do encourage people to engage in the chats as well. Do say hello and where you come from and what organisation you work for, as we're not able to meet up in any great numbers in person yet. We do look forward to that day coming. Please remember all chats and questions are recorded. We're going to keep the event strictly to an hour to avoid Zoom overload. There's plenty of that around. And the hashtag for today's conversation is hashtag IWA Media. Many of you will know that the IWA has been a long-standing commentator on the weakness of the media in Wales and the democratic deficit it creates. We last gathered online to discuss this at our media summit in January this year, 2021, where we first floated the idea that the Welsh Government should create a contestable fund for independent journalism. Since then, the previous Senate's Culture, Welsh Language and Communications Committee has adopted the same recommendation as part of their report on broadcasting. The idea has widespread support from stakeholders, and we were delighted that all four parties now in the Senate committed to support this before the election in May. Our next task is to convert that support into action. And if you really want to help us achieve that and you're not yet a member of the IWA, why don't you consider joining us or making a donation? There'll be a link in the chat shortly. Today's event, in partnership with the Media Reform Coalition, is a useful reminder that the problems that Wales faces regarding its media are not unique within the UK or even beyond. The way that people consume news is changing, and there's ever-increasing competition from media producers and platforms globally. At the same time, the stories that people want to tell and be told are changing too, particularly in Wales. We may be an old nation, but we have a young and vulnerable democracy, and the ground on which it has been developed has also shifted over time. With the new Welsh Government proposing a constitutional convention around radical federalism, quote unquote, and a national conversation to inform it, a rapid step change to our media feels more urgent than ever. How can any nation hold a conversation about its future without a healthy, independent, pluralist media to engage and inform the public and help people make up their own minds? The monoliths of public service broadcasting of the past are having to adjust to all of these challenges. Writing for our blog, The Welsh Agenda, Rhodri Talvin Davis set out the BBC's new strategic goal to recreate itself as a truly UK-wide organisation, decentralising power and decision-making across the four nations. But a healthy media landscape cannot depend on any single organisation, so the central question of the Media Reform Coalition's work is how do we imagine public media, reimagine public media for the digital age? For the IWA, this means supporting independent Made in Wales provision at a local level for all the many definitions of local. And yes, we do know the picture isn't all doom and gloom. Ever since our media summit in January, we've had a new national newspaper launched for Wales, and websites such as nation.cymru, voice.wales and others continue to provide news and national commentary from a range of perspectives. We also know that hyperlocal journalism is a growing part of the media landscape. With the right support, we hope these new providers and others like them will be here to stay. We've heard many times about the problems, but today's event is about looking forward. We'll hear about solutions, innovations, and how we could embed these in Wales, with a contestable news front from Welsh Government as a crucial part of the picture. Debs, over to you to get us going, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Auriel, and hello, everyone. Before I introduce today's speakers and we start the discussion, I just wanted to say a bit about the BBC and Beyond, which is the Media Reform Coalition campaign that I work on. This is a campaign about public media. What we mean by public media are media institutions that act in the public interest rather than the interests of politicians or wealthy owners. In some ways, it's an aspiration. We think that public media should be independent, able to hold powerful interests to account. They should be accountable themselves, facing consequences when they do harm. They should be democratic, participatory, and representative of diverse lives. And they should be for everyone, serving everybody's needs and accessible to all. This definition of public media is deliberately broad enough to include our public broadcasters, the BBC, S4C and Channel 4, as well as smaller independent media outlets such as media cooperatives and democratically run community media. These organisations are often the ones that can most closely live out this ideal definition of public media, particularly when it comes to participation, and they will be the starting point for the discussion today, although I'm sure we will talk about public broadcasting in Wales as well. It's fantastic that we've been able to collaborate with the IWA on this event because their proposals for a new independent journalism fund fit really well with our approach of trying to see public media as including, but also going beyond the BBC. This event is part of a series we've been running, which will feed into a manifesto for a people's media that we'll be writing later this year. All our previous events are available on the MRC YouTube channel, and participants here may be particularly interested in the one that we held last week on public media and constitutional crisis, focusing on Northern Ireland, and the one earlier this week on Scottish public media. If you have ideas you think should be included in our manifesto for a people's media, you can contribute via the BBC and Beyond website. And we will also use the discussion and the chat from today, so do get involved. I'm now going to introduce today's speakers. So we have Lucas Batt. Lucas is a membership coordinator at the Bristol Cable, which is a member-owned cooperative print and online media outlet, which uses pioneering methods of in-person and digital engagement to put the public at the centre of public interest journalism. We have Shirish Kulkarni, who is an award-winning journalist, researcher and community organiser with more than 25 years experience working in all the UK's major broadcast newsrooms. Over the last 2 years, he's been carrying out research into innovative forms of news storytelling funded by the Cluster Programme in South Wales. We have Emma Mees, who is Director of Independent Community News Network and Centre for Community Journalism at Cardiff University. She is passionate about giving community journalism access to the highest standing of training in digital and social media. She works with news publishers, academics, governments, charities and businesses worldwide with the aim of strengthening and sustaining the community news sector. And finally, we have Andy Regan, who is Policy and External Affairs Manager at the IWA. Amongst other things, he has been overseeing their work on media policy, including developing ideas about how the Welsh Government could support a more diverse and innovative independent media ecosystem in Wales. So I wanted to start the discussion with a question for Emma and for Shirish. So in the BBC and Beyond campaign, as I said, we're defining public media as media institutions that are independent, accountable, democratic, and for everyone. So I wondered if you could say something about which institutions in Wales do you think are currently most successful at living out some of these principles, and how could they be supported to do better? Emma, do you want to start? You're on mute still.
I need another t-shirt, you're on mute, don't I? Hi there. So I think in Wales, we are very fortunate with the size and the scale of the country that we can explore and experiment with our media. But unfortunately, we seem to have been stuck in a rut for a long time. And we kind of go with, this is what we've got, and this is how it's always happened. And if you'd have asked people years ago, what do you want? They'd have said faster horses, because they wouldn't have thought of cars. And I feel that when we're in Wales, we're kind of in that. We've got the BBC, we've got ITV Wales, we've got reach. When you look at newsprint media, they have the monopoly. We've got a spattering of NewsQuest, and we kind of keep looking at what do we need to do to keep bolstering what we've already got. So I think in terms of trying to be sort of impartial and independent, you know, the main organisation there is the BBC, as you've mentioned. But what we do have is this new emerging landscape. And it's not that new. I mean, I set up the Centre for Community Journalism in Wales 9 years ago this week, actually. So we're not that new anymore. Is this new landscape of independent media. And to be a member of ICNN, the Independent Community News Network, you have to pass quite a stringent entry criteria. And you have to be free from any bias, be that political, commercial, religious or other. So we are now starting to see this network of small independent news publishers. And when I say small, I mean small by the size of the newsroom, not small in terms of reach, in terms of reach, engagement, impact on communities. Their impact is massive. But what you have are these small independent newsrooms that are still on the peripheries when we're looking at legislation, when we're still looking at guidelines, when we're still looking at funding, when we're looking at things like access to statutory notices, when we're looking at things like access to government health spend, they're still not included. So what we're seeing is larger news organisations are closing newsrooms, sacking journalists. And what we're doing is seeing this new sector plug in the gap. So, you know, re-entering communities where there's a news desert or a news black hole, but still not having, it's not a level playing field. We're still not having access to the same funding and support as previously. So I think what we need to start doing now, as Aurel said earlier about looking forward, is to look at how do we lay foundations for a strong future. So if we keep looking backwards and going, how do we stop this building from crumbling? We've got crumbling building. If you think of infrastructure as crumbling, what we're trying to do is we kind of go, oh, well, let's put a bit of grout in here and a bit of cement in there and let's see if we can prop it up. And instead, there's new buildings coming up. There's barren land and there's, you know, there's fantastic new things happening and we're putting all our focus. So we need to start looking at the landscape as a whole. And I'm not saying let's not put some scaffolding on what we've got, but let's also start looking about laying strong foundations to move forward. And, you know, we've got lots of opportunity here. And I think it's been a particularly exciting time for us to now be working together on how do we have one strong media. Because I've always said, you know, I've never once said that Reach are going to withdraw from Wales. But what I've always said is picture the scene if they did. If Reach decided to suddenly withdraw from Wales, what does our landscape look like? And suddenly it looks very, very different to what we've got at the moment. So we need to start looking at how do we now start taking all our eggs out of, you know, one or two baskets and start looking at, you know, getting it, spreading it wider to make sure that we have strong foundations. I'll mute myself again now.
Yeah, I'm happy to pick up on that. Like, 100% agree with everything Emma said. And looking at it from an editorial perspective, which is really my sort of area of experience, I'm generally very solutions focused, but actually I'm quite, yeah, I suppose I see more problems. So, you know, I see like, you know, members of the ICNN, you know, brilliant organisations like Nation.Cymru, I know events here, you know, for the Observer, Cumbria Life, doing actually, you know, really interesting things and really serving a public service remit. But what I see as actually a particular problem in Wales is that actually we are a little bit, as Emma says, doing the same things we've always done, and actually largely the same people. And I know people like Yvonne would agree with this, that actually we can't just have a media that is white, male, middle class, doing the same things as we've always done, because that hasn't worked. That's kind of why we're in the mess we're in now, because we're not meeting the needs of huge proportions of the population. And that's a problem with media in general, but I think it's a particular problem in Wales, to be honest. So I think, you know, when we talk about, you know, contestable funds, the future of journalism, as Emma talks about, I think that's got to be focused on A, innovation, doing things differently, with a kind of real focus on meeting the needs of citizens, users, whatever, but also on meeting broader needs for equity and diversity. I hate the word diversity because, you know, we already exist, we're all diverse, but that broader need for equity and meeting the needs of, you know, more of the population, frankly. You know, and I've, you know, worked in London for 20 years, you know, people just, you know, as I wrote for the Institute a couple of months ago, you know, London doesn't care about us, but equally, we need to care about, in Wales, we need to care about the communities we're not, people and communities we're not reaching. And actually, this is slightly secret. Emma knows a bit about this, but in my role at Bureau Local, we are moving to doing a slightly separate project, which is about the future of journalism in this way. And I'm going to be starting, which I can't talk about a lot, a particular subset of that based in Wales, doing exactly what I'm talking about, which I'm starting today, in fact. So this is well timed. And so we will be talking more about that. But that is essentially working with young people of colour to create a newsroom for a particular audience and to do a particular purpose.
That's brilliant. And Andy, it'd be great to hear from you a bit more about this contestable journalism fund that the IWA has proposed. What do you think are the most important things to consider in its design? So the most kind of important criteria for delivering media in the public interest.
Yeah, thanks, Deb. I mean, Shirish has already kind of covered a little of what we would want it to achieve around kind of in innovation, though I think it's also important to say it shouldn't only fund new things. But I guess the starting point is to unpack slightly what we mean when we say contestable. So contestability, it's partly about having openness and transparency around why certain organisations get funded. So it's not just like a bilateral deal between, you know, the government or a particular provider. There's a process that everyone can kind of compete into. It's often kind of done on the basis of cost. It's a word that's very much associated with, you know, getting the lowest cost for something. But I think in this instance, and I you know, don't underestimate how complex it would be to design it on this basis, it would be contestability around some sort of core mission of what the fund is trying to achieve. And that would very much include everything that Shirish has just set out. But I think the key thing to me is that the things that get funded from this need to be journalist-led. They need to be driven by the people who are actually delivering it. So the kind of what we don't want to end up with is, to borrow Emma's insight, we don't want a faster horses fund. We want something that's going to fund things that are delivered from the ground. And I think that will be best achieved if it is not designed in a dark room somewhere, but has a fairly kind of open mission basis of what it's trying to achieve around the democratic deficit, around pluralism and representation and independence. But the actual model of what are you trying to do is being driven from the ground. So you don't have a kind of shopping list of, well, we'll give you £5,000 to start with a local blog, and then you end up with, you know, dozens and dozens of local blogs kind of going unread. That it really is putting the kind of innovation at the heart of it. The other really important principle would be around independence and perceptions of independence. So there's, you know, obvious potential problems in a government funding news, and the perception of the news that is, you know, that is coming out of that. So there were two levels at which that would need to be addressed. I think everybody agrees that this fund would need to be delivered by some sort of arm's length body rather than, you know, the civil service directly. So there'd be some kind of governance things to work through there, and probably some kind of cross-party input to appointing, you know, the trustees or the board of whatever this organisation looked like. So there's a kind of cross-party buy-in to the idea that this doesn't just become effectively, you know, a mouthpiece for the Labour Party, you know, as the incumbent government. But also, and I think we'll hear a bit more about this from Lucas hopefully in a moment, is part of that perception of independence must also come from the other direction and from the grassroots up, so that people kind of, because they have a stake in the things that get funded by this fund, that again helps with the perception that this isn't just like the official government news outlet sort of thing. And, you know, Lucas has much more to say about what that looks like in practice. And finally, just I think there's an essay question at the heart of how this needs to be designed, which is the government going into this on the basis that the market for news in Wales is always going to be so difficult that no kind of news organisation is ever going to be able to stand on its own two feet financially? I don't have a view on that yet, but I'm really interested to hear from people about the health of the market. But the government will need to decide whether this is a fund where you put money in perpetuity and you get news out, or do you design it in such a way that you're effectively trying to help those organisations stand on their own two feet and effectively kind of, you know, outcompete other providers on the basis of the quality of what they're doing or on the basis of the local buy-in that they would achieve. And that's going to be a really important part of the design. And it's one where I don't quite have a fixed view on it yet. And we're hoping to do more work on that with partners in the next few months. So obviously really interested to hear from anybody in the audience about their views on that. But in a nutshell, very big nutshell, that's how I see it working.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think we'll come on to Lucas in a second. I'd just like to say that one of the things that we've really noticed through having conversations with English audiences is that the concept of public media and something being publicly funded and genuinely independent of the state, there's real cynicism about the possibility of that in an English context. I think it's particularly severe, that lack of trust. And one of the things that's really interesting about this conversation is that it seems that the public perception or feeling around things being publicly funded, but there being some realistic chance that they are not just delivering kind of government policy, there seems to be more of an openness to that in Wales, potentially. So Lucas, let's hear from you. So people in Wales may not be familiar with the Bristol Cable model. Can you talk us through what it is that you do differently?
Sure, and tell me when to stop. So the Bristol Cable was founded in 2014 to address the crisis of local media and the crisis of corporately owned local media, which had resulted in declining quality, clickbait, declining trust from audiences and communities. We needed to see a way out of that, and we thought, let's just start again. So we spoke with local people, community members, and we did a bit of crowdfunding. We produced a newspaper and we said, let's create a cooperative. Now we're a cooperative with 2,600 people who each have a legal stake in the organisation and help fund us. We're about 37% member funded, working towards the magic goal of 100% one day. The rest is 5% about advertising and a lot of grant funding, which is given on the basis that we will prove a new model for local media and share those learnings. So that's very much what we're doing, is we're trying to create a new model of local media which centers community involvement. As a cooperative, that means we can't ever be bought, or we can't sell out, because our connection to the public is not predicated upon any kind of public government ownership or corporate ownership, but it's based on an individual basis of thousands of people in the local community who are willing to support us. And that means that our journalism is conscious of how we are engaging and serving that community at every step of the way. We are accountable literally through the funding, but also through the democratic processes we have in this organization. We have a board of reader members who represent member interests. We have regular democratic engagement, including our annual general meeting, where members help shape the direction and we're accountable to members there. So as an organization, we are really built on the idea that news organizations are a public asset. They're part of the local community infrastructure, and therefore they should have a level of accountability and engagement with local people in perpetuity. In terms of our journalism and what we would do, we prioritize impactful journalism and things that matter to people. So that's investigative journalism, holding power to account. That's raising up marginalized voices that are often excluded or misrepresented in the media. We prioritize community engagement. We think our journalism is made better by involving the people that it's about. We look at membership not just as a way of funding local media, but a way of improving it, a way of rethinking how journalism is made, from the story selection, the prioritization, to the getting feedback on drafts and things like that. So we're really looking at every aspect of local media and rethinking how should it work, and going along the lines of principles of, well, it needs to be accountable, much more part of communities. It needs to be serving those communities. It needs to be doing things for them. I think that's kind of a broad overview. I'm happy to go into detail on any more things that you'd like to follow up on.
No, that's brilliant. And how replicable do you think your model is? You said that a lot of your grant funding is based on the fact that you're trying to build a replicable model and share those findings. So do you think it could be rolled out across Wales or other parts of the UK?
Well, we're still trying to prove that it works in Bristol. I think there are things that can be taken from it, learnings that could be taken from it. But it's not a copy-paste model at this point. And it might not be that any model is a simple copy-paste in different contexts. It might perhaps work in Cardiff or a similarly sized city. I think we are making improvements in understanding exactly what we need to be doing in terms of proving our messaging or improving the ways in which people can engage and see the value and benefits of being a member. But I know, for example, the Port Talbot Magnet is an example of a media organisation that was going along the same lines of the Bristol Cable in terms of membership, community involvement. But there are distinct problems around how to reach communities that may be less engaged in news or from lower incomes. And I think there will need to be specific strategies and ways of involving those communities. So it's definitely not a one size fits all, but I'm confident that we can prove the model that works in Bristol and that there'll be learnings to take away from that, be it the values that we operate under or certain principles of community engagement, ways of working. I think at the very least, more experiments like this needs to be happening so that other people are working in different contexts, getting their learnings and feedback. And the more that other people are working on it, innovating with new models, the more we're going to be able to push those boundaries and figure out what is going to work in different contexts.
And Emma and Shirish, what do you think in terms of, do you have reflections on whether Wales could develop these kinds of models, what some of the specific issues might be about transplanting these ideas? Or Emma, it seems like
I put my hand up just before Lucas said about the Port Talbot Magnet, because I actually worked with the Port Talbot Magnet towards the end before they wrapped up. And I think what I've learned, so when before we started ICNN, and my job 9 years ago was to set up the Centre for Community Journalism at Cardiff University, and the head of school at the time, Professor Justin Lewis, was fed up of going to conferences globally and everybody were wailing about the death of local journalism, going, oh, what are we going to do? What are we losing? What's happening? And he said, actually, why do we put our money where our mouths are and say, why don't we see if we can invest in helping and nurturing these green shoots, little new independent titles, these hyperlocals popping up everywhere. Why don't we see if we can support them as best we can? So our remit for the first 5 years at Cardiff University was to work intensively with at least 10 different communities to see if we could set up independent news titles and see what we could do to kind of, was there a one size fits all? Was there a formula we could come up with? And the answer was, there is no formula. The difference is that every single community is different and the needs are different. So what we learned, so we set up the Rhondda People in Rhondda, which was an English language title, and we could have lost the website, we could have lost all social media apart from Facebook. Facebook was massive. It's the way they communicate, it's the way they kind of, you know, find out information from each other. And don't even get me started on people say they get their news from Facebook. Don't get me started on that. So Dr. Rachel Howells, who was the editor of the Port Talbot Magnet, has done a whole thesis, has done a whole PhD doctorate on this. So if anybody's interested in what happens to communities when there's a news black hole, such as Port Talbot, when they lose access to all dedicated media and all they're left with are Facebook groups, then that is a very interesting read. And then in Cardiff, we set up Pobl Caerdydd, which was a Welsh language. It was a community of interest within a geographical community, and we could have lost everything except for the Twitter account there. Twitter was massive. So that in itself is some learning based on whether, you know, your city, rural, you know, socioeconomic, even down to the platforms that you use are very, very different. So, you know, I know that Port Talbot looked at doing the same thing, but when you compare a vibrant, creative city like Bristol and an area such as Port Talbot, they're very, very different communities. So to try and replicate that just didn't work. So, you know, I think there are certain things that we've learned in that if people have social cohesion before setting up a news publication. If you bring a group of strangers together, it's less likely to succeed. If you bring people with social cohesion together, this is just from my learning from doing this for the last 9 years. If somebody says, you know, it's, picture the scene, it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, it's December, it's absolutely tipping down with rain, you're absolutely shattered, you've been in work all day, you just want to sit down, put your feet up in front of the telly, and you might go, oh, do you know what? I'm going to miss the editorial meeting this week because, oh, they won't miss me. Whereas if your friend Phyllis says, come on, I'll toot for you outside at 5 to 7, I'll pick you up, you feel that, like, oh, I better not let her down. And even just the basics of having that kind of social cohesion, first of all, rather than just, oh, they're not going to miss me, far more likely to succeed. And if there are organisations within the community who, within their roles and remit, is to help share news and information, so community groups, if you can get them involved as well, it's far more likely to succeed. So, you know, I'm really interested in, there's lots of things that we've come up with as guidelines, that things you need to consider before you set up a news publication. But there isn't, unfortunately, a one size fits all. And I think this is, you know, really fascinating for us to learn and understand what the different wants and needs of different communities are and how can we best serve those. Because at the moment, I don't think, you know, there's lots of experimentation and there's lots of new entrants to the market, but I don't think anybody's nailed it yet.
Yeah, and I guess that really raises the question with a contestable journalism fund, then you're using a set of common criteria, but you're potentially trying to compare very different projects because they're trying to adapt to different circumstances.
Yeah, and that's the thing with our members, is that because it's one, you know, and it could be a sole trader, it could be social enterprise, it could be cooperative, it can be, you know, the business models vary wildly, but they're generally people that live and work in those communities. More often than not, they're people that are, you know, already journalists, have lost their jobs in mainstream journalism, passionate about continuing to work in journalism in those communities. So they know and understand the communities anyway. So that's the difference with an ICNN publication setting up. And I'm not saying that, you know, we are the solution or anything, but we are definitely trying to be a part of the solution, in that we do understand that it isn't a one size fits all. So when somebody sets up, the business model will vary wildly, maybe from two villages apart, maybe 2.5 miles apart, and the business model could vary wildly. And it's important that we look at that community, you know, how do they access news and information already? What else exists out there? You know, what are the provision is there? What are the wants? What are the needs? How can we best serve those communities? So we've got a member who set up Inksplot in Splot in Cardiff. And whilst there's plenty of mainstream media that covers what happens in Cardiff, when you look at Splot as a community, they're often overlooked, often forgotten, low socioeconomic community, higher number of elderly. So now they have a dedicated newspaper with larger print, you know, the actual font is bigger because they print to go out through the doors of the elderly in the community, which has led to litter picks, which has led to a lot more community cohesion. And that is very specific to that community. It wouldn't service the needs of the rest of Cardiff. And that's what we need to start looking at, is which are these communities that are totally underrepresented. And these are the communities we find, you know, I've done lots of work with the Gurnos in Merthyr. Unfortunately, with these kinds of communities, people have a preconceived idea of what the stories are in those communities. And when you speak to people living, breathing, you know, working in those communities, there's so many amazing, fabulous things that happen in those communities, but they never get reported. It's the litter, it's the dog fouling, it's the crime, it's the unemployment. And that's what we need to address, is, you know, let's share the news that's important to those communities, not what we think they should be, the stories should be from there.
I can see Andy raising his hand, but maybe let's hear from Shireesh on that question and then come back to you, Andy.
Yeah, 100% agree with Emma, and that there's not a one size fits all answer. There clearly can't be, and there shouldn't be. What I think there is, and what we're kind of working on, is the questions to ask at every stage of creating. And how do you meet the needs of your specific audience? Because the problem with journalism, and look, I spent 25 years doing this largely in London newsrooms, journalism is almost never done with any of the interests of the audience in mind. Morning meetings, you know, at Sky or ITV or BBC, the conversation is largely focused on what's going to look cool to other journalists, right? There's never a thought, what do people actually need to know about this story? And this is something I've looked at in the kind of the storytelling work I've done. What do people actually need to know to help orientate themselves in the world, to understand whether this new policy, this new development is a good or bad thing for them? And it sounds obvious, right? That's the purpose of journalism, but so little journalism actually meets that function. So in as Emma says, in working with communities, and it's the first rule of community organizing, right? Coming from my community organizing background, don't create and start with a network that already exists. As Emma said, you're starting something from scratch, trying to create a community from scratch is A, really difficult, and B, fraught with exactly the dangers Emma described. So that's kind of what we're doing with this new project. And on the kind of public, you know, the kind of the public financing of this stuff, I would provide a skeptical voice. And I think you're exactly right, Deb, that in Wales, there's much more of a kind of fatalism about public, like, yeah, they're just doing their best. You know, even when things go wrong, they're doing their best. So as an example, well, two things really. And there's also too much of a coziness. The public sphere in Wales is too small and too cozy. So there's not enough scrutiny of government. So an example, you know, the thing I'm probably best known for in Wales is uncovering the British Steel pension scandal, right? That was a £26 billion scam, which started with the Welsh government funding the company at the heart of this, giving them 120 grand nearly, right? So that the British Steel pension scandal might not have existed without the Welsh government funding that, right? The Welsh government has never on camera answered a question on that. And part of the problem with that is people don't want to ask the question. Yeah, it's just, oh, they're just doing their best. So I think there is a problem with, you know, buy-in and trust around public funding on this stuff. So yeah, I think we do need, there's not a one size fits all answer. I think I have questions around public funding, because actually what that does mean is, in a way, it takes away the impetus to really meet the needs of your audience. Say, well, actually we've got to get membership funding, or we've got to get advertising, because we've got to make a product that really meets people's needs, because we're getting the funding anyway. And I'm not some Adam Smith kind of invisible hand guy, quite the opposite. But we do need to remember to focus on what is the thing that people are going to find value in. And the final thing I'd say on that is, Lucas and I had this conversation a couple of weeks ago. Sometimes we think about, you know, what do I need to do to get people to care about my publication? And I flip that around. And I think the thing that is really lacking is us caring about communities. And there's so much value for communities in them feeling cared about by media organizations, that we're looking out for their interests, that actually I think that could be really transformative. And that's what we're going to base all our work on.
Okay, Andy, do you want to come in, and then we'll go to audience questions?
Yeah, so I think that's a really helpful and fair challenge from Shirish. It's about the idea of news funding. And I've kind of, in the back of my mind, have it as one of the success criteria for the fund existing would be ministers in the Welsh government wishing they'd never done it. So that's sort of, don't tell anyone I said that, obviously, but I think that's quite a key part of it. And I think just reflecting on partly on what Emma said, so I live in I benefit from Inkspot's insights locally, and I kind of really resonates with me what you're saying about telling the story about areas of where I live, because I'm also a school governor. And what happens at our school sometimes is that journalists decide they want to tell a story about poverty, or story about like what happens in deprived communities, and that's the only time that the phone gets picked up to kind of feature our school. And there's lots of positive stories to be told about our school and our community too. And I think that's one thing that is a really important factor in local journalism, because bad news is not the only news, but it's very kind of attractive from a kind of clicks point of view. And I think it also reinforces the trust and around, again, addressing what Shirish has said, is that if you know that your local paper or your local media outlet, whatever it is, tells the bad stories when bad stories are happening, and then you will also trust them when they tell good news stories about your community. And I think one of the things that has really driven my own interest in this, thinking about this, the Senedd and devolution and the current kind of threats to devolution, is there's such a kind of void of information around the Senedd, or has been historically. There's certainly more of it now with Nation and the National in particular kind of coming out, giving more coverage. But it's very easy to fill a complete void around a parliament's activities with just whatever people want to say about it. So we need stories, both good and bad, about, you know, democracy in Wales, so that people can make up their own minds. That void isn't being filled by, you know, actors of bad intent.
I think that leads actually quite neatly onto one of the questions that we've had from Kereth Rees-Jones. Says, taking as read that we need to have a richer, more pluralistic media in Wales to achieve better democratic engagement, what's the other side of the coin? So what do we need to do to equip citizens with the ability to think critically about the news and the information that they consume? And I think that really comes to something that we're going to try and have in the manifesto as well, of like sometimes problems which exist within the media are actually part of much bigger problems in society and can't best necessarily be addressed through media policy. So I guess, I don't know who would like to answer that question. Emma?
Sorry, Shirish, I think you might have picked me to the post of your hand. Do you want to go? Fine. So I think it comes down to education. I think it comes down to resources and education. So I think I think when we rely on social media, you get fed by the algorithm. So if you get fed stories that feed into this kind of echo chamber and echo bubble. So if we can start to provide, put more good quality local journalism out there that gets in front of people, they'll start to realise, do you know what? I didn't know I needed to know this. It's that need to know basis, and then they start to get more information. But a big thing for me is education in schools. So this is not a quick answer. You're talking about a generational answer by the time they've had this education through school and they leave. So one of the things we've done, I mentioned I've done some work in Portalbed, and that was to run an after school club, a journalism after school club, where they set up their own news publication called North Merthyr Voice, and two primary schools, and the ones that, exactly as Andy was saying, they only get bad news stories written about them. So what we've done is, it was at the time of the referendum, so I was going up one evening a week to both schools, so two evenings a week I was going up to Merthyr, and running these after school clubs and teaching them, if your voices are not being heard, here are the tools to tell your own stories. And it's one of the only after school clubs they've ever run where more people joined as the weeks went on rather than left. And we made sure their parent or guardian had to come along with them as well. And it's, we've repackaged that. So I've worked closely with BECTU in Wales, the teaching union, and we've now got a 10-week resource, a 10-week programme, a train-the-trainer programme, which is called the Making News Toolkit in Wales. And it's there, it's been translated, it's in Welsh and in English. And what I would love to see more than anything is this rolled out to every single school in Wales. It's a free resource. It works within the digital competency framework. It works at every key stage level. And, you know, when you hear about a Making News Toolkit, people think about, you know, oh, well, we're creating journalists of the future, which is brilliant. You know, if we get, you know, one or two children in every class that would like to go into journalism, brilliant. But we know that not everybody's going to want to. But it's as important that we create engaged citizens of the future. So by having this kind of education, not only is it hands-on, it's fun, it's, you know, it's a good thing that even if somebody's been homeschooled due to COVID, parents can do it. But actually what we're doing is we're teaching them to question. So if you read something on Facebook, doesn't mean it's true. So, you know, have a look at who's written it before you retweet or reshare or like or comment. Where's that come from? And teach them about local news sources. So, OK, somebody's given you the seed of a story. Before you go off and share that wildly, where do you go and check that out? Who are your local news titles, you know, verified, trusted? where can you go and get both sides of the story? Where can you learn the other side of the argument? And things also about, you know, privacy and verification and all that kind of stuff. And what the aim is that by teaching this in schools, we are then teaching and giving the capacity to young people as they grow older. You know, in Wales they can vote from 16 now. So, you know, we need to be prepping them from, you know, 10, 11 onwards to understand what it means. Where do you go and find information on your local election, your local candidate, just because somebody shares something? So let's try and move away from this, I shared it, I read it on Facebook. Let's try and educate and inform and create engaged citizens of the future, which I'd love to see.
Yeah, I can pick up on that, because I 100% agree with Emma. And I think actually that's also a big part of kind of solving the inclusion problem, because I have a lot of thoughts on diversity internships, which I think are, you know, shambolic way of dealing with that problem. But actually working with people younger and working with their families is a really important way to build a pipeline where there are more people who want to be journalists, right? That see it as a positive thing. But I would again provide kind of a counterpoint to the question. I'm quite hard line on this, but I think the quite often the answer to our problems is to blame it on the audience, right? Say they don't understand, right? Well, actually, isn't it a problem with our journalism? Because if we look at, you know, the way the BBC News or ITV News, how, for example, use anonymous sources in politics, and then we're surprised that people are skeptical, right? Because journalists think, oh, I've got this anonymous source because I'm such an amazing journalist. Now, we all know that we only get those tip-offs or whatever because there's a purpose served for the person giving it to us, right? And a really good example is the Reuters Institute digital news report last year asked people across the world, you know, what do you regard as the biggest source of misinformation? So they asked actual readers and users and viewers, what do you regard as the biggest source of misinformation? Domestic politicians. But we instinctively go to a quote from a domestic politician. We had Labour says this, Conservatives say this, Lib Dems says. Now, most stories don't actually need that. You and I as journalists could tell you what politicians are going to say before they say it, because it's coming from an ideology. It's not coming from a position of information, which is actually, as I say, going back to the thing, does it help me understand whether this is a good or bad thing? It helps me understand what politicians' ideologies are. So actually, can we do better in our storytelling at explaining stories? So we actually crowd out the misinformation because we have really good sources of information that we're creating.
I think that's all really interesting. And the idea that actually it is through active participation that a whole set of these issues around trust could be rebuilt, and these kind of critical skills can be learned, not as this kind of abstract thing. But also there's something there about breaking down some of the boundaries around what is seen as kind of the professional journalist and then, you know, everyone else who just receives things passively. Yeah, I think those are all things that we're really trying to think of for the manifesto. We've got a number of other questions, and I might just read them out and then you can choose which one you want to answer. But I also do have a question that I really want to ask Lucas, which is this question of if this contestable journalism fund existed, would the Bristol Cable apply? Like, would this appeal to you? And then I'll run through the other questions.
Okay. Well, it depends on the exact way that it's pitched, but I think we would ask our members about it, and we would say, hey, look, this is the information about this thing, this is how it's structured. If we were sure that there was no mechanism in which this fund would undermine our independence, like our grant funding, then why not? I think we desperately need money to better serve our communities, broaden our reach, hire more reporters, do more community engagement. And if the money would help us do that, and I think definitely, I think we would be doing a disservice to our communities to not take that money. But the really essential thing that when we look at taking money is communicating extremely clearly where the money is coming from, being totally honest about that, what it means editorially, that it will have no impact on editorial. And so, yeah, if such a fund came up, we would have to look very closely at what that meant, even if it's in this subtle power structures, whether how confident we would feel about that. You know, in the past, we have consulted with members at our AGM about whether we would take money from Google, which has done a lot of funding for media and local media across Europe for through the Digital News Initiative Fund. And members overwhelmingly said yes. And we didn't end up pitching for money for Google. We actually went with a fund called Luminate in the end. But that gave us the confidence about the principles, the rationale, and the sense of honesty and integrity when we're going for funding. So I think if such a fund came up, yeah, I think we would look at it. If it didn't undermine our independence, it didn't affect the way in which we could be editorially independent, then yeah, we'd go for it. And we'd ask members if that's all right.
Okay, so I'm just going to read out some of the questions that we have, and then you can take your pick what you'd like to answer. So there's a question about the BBC's local democracy reporting service. What assessment do you have of that? And what role do you see for the BBC to use licence fee revenue to support non-BBC news sources? There's a question about, do we need to distinguish more clearly between three separate challenges? One is giving people a voice. Another is developing professional scrutiny at the local and national level. And three, increasing the scope for journalism of opinion. There's also a question which was asking particularly about the Port Talbot context. So saying, is it's now a news black hole minus the magnet. How many more black holes exist and towns with no effective news coverage? I know that across the UK, it's astonishingly high, the number of local authority areas that do not have a daily newspaper. It's definitely over 50%. I think it may be over 60% now. And then a question about, do you agree that the job of Welsh media is made much harder because UK media does so badly at reporting on Wales? And finally, a question about the role for the Senedd. The previous Senedd Commission spoke of a desire to support independent journalism. What role do panellists see for the Senedd itself, and how could this complement any support from the Welsh Government? Do you like to pick any of those to answer, Emma?
Well, because I'm quite gobby, I've got opinions on all of them, so I don't really know which to pick. But so I think with Port Talbot, you know, I have to be very careful when I say here, when I say there's no media in Port Talbot, then the Evening Post get quite sniffy and say, but we cover Port Talbot. What I mean is there was the Neath and Port Talbot Guardian. I did my work experience. I've been a journalist for over 25 years, and I did my work experience in the Evening Post offices in Swansea. And I, you know, sat in Ammanford, and I've sat in Neath, and I've sat in Port Talbot in their offices. You know, there's no newspaper. So even if something might be in a nib somewhere, say, you know, this has happened to have happened in Port Talbot. So I just want to make it absolutely clear. But yeah, there's huge numbers. So if you look at areas like that where there's no longer a dedicated news publication for the town and area, and other or larger organizations will say, but we cover them, and I would argue, but do you really? So there's my kind of, you know, so I think in terms of what we class as news deserts, where people pertain to say they cover an area, and whether they actually cover an area, you might have a big patch, but very, very little, you know, fresh dedicated news and information will come out of that area. So if you look at it in that way, then we've got, you know, huge a piece of work to do in order to try and even begin about tackling the news deserts and the news black holes that we've got. You know, if you count in ghost titles, where there is a title for an area but there's no dedicated reporters. And actually, when you have those ghost titles, there's a benefit to larger organisations in keeping those titles, because you get statutory notices, you get access to government health spend, and actually the money that brings into the larger news organisations far exceeds, you know, it's worth keeping those. So you might have a 12-page newspaper, 9 pages of those might be adverts, and 3 pages of news. So again, I would argue that is still a news black hole if there's nothing that covers that particular area. The BBC Local Democracy Reporter Scheme, I know that some of our members were quite apprehensive when that scheme first launched, and I just got to put a caveat, I sit on the BBC's advisory board for the LDR scheme as well. in that they were saying, well, we are the only ones locally that cover, you know, the courts and the councils and everything else. So this is going to be bad for us because everybody else is going to get the stories that are unique to us at the moment. But it seemed, you know, we seem to have found a level playing field. And again, it's on an area by area basis. Sometimes it works better than other areas. There were some teething problems to start with people claiming ownership of the LDRs, and they would turn up in council meetings and say, I'm from such and such a title, rather than being identified as a local democracy reporter. But in all fairness to the BBC, they've been working quite hard to kind of try and iron out any of those kinks. So I think in theory, the BBC reporter scheme has worked really well. When it works well, it works really well. And what it does is it frees up resources. If somebody knows that a council meeting's being covered that you would ordinarily go and do, that frees you up to either get some additional background info or to go and cover other stories. So I think there's definitely something there, there's scope there to kind of look at that model where everybody works together. Because I remember 25 years ago, you know, being a court reporter and, you know, there's a big case in court number one and another one in court number three. And I'd work with another journalist and say, right, OK, well, you cover one, I'll cover nine, and we'll swap the results at the end and we'll go off and do our own stories, which in theory is not dissimilar to what's happening here, as everybody's kind of pooling resources. And I think we've lost that. I think we're rated lower than estate agents at the moment as journalists, which is pretty poor, isn't it? Have we lost this art of collaboration? And I think, you know, maybe that's something that we need to be looking at, is working together for the greater good here. It doesn't have to be an us or them, and people worry when something else pops up. When you look at how many reporters, we were 14 reporters in the Carmarthen Journal newsroom when I started as a trainee reporter. Now there isn't one, there's no office there. It's all centralised content. So, you know, don't tell me there's no room for more journalists, there's no room for competition. There's plenty of room. We just need to find a way of doing it properly. I'm going to shut up now before I even go on to the others because I lose a ball of time.
Yeah, we've just got a couple of minutes left.
Can I pick up on Geraint Talvin's question about distinguishing between those three separate challenges? Because I think it's a really important one, and I may be slightly misunderstanding it, but I think it's an important point to make anyway, that actually I don't think it's separate challenges. I think, you know, speaking as a journalist of colour, for example, I have very rarely done stories which are about race, right? Because I can be an investigative journalist, I can do opinion, I have a voice, right? And sometimes, you know, this goes back to my feelings about diversity internships, people are only seen as, I'm going to slightly bite the hand that feeds me here, and I am, and this isn't a criticism of the IWA, and I understand why this happens. When I wrote about this for the IWA a couple of months ago, it was under the Emerging Voices banner. Like, I'm 50 years old. I've been a journalist for 25 years. I'm not an emerging voice, but that's where issues of race or diversity get pushed, right? So people exist who are already great journalists, or people of colour who are disabled, who are LGBTQ+I, whatever, right? All these people exist. We are historically and currently marginalising and underrepresenting them in our industry. So these aren't kind of little niches where we fit into. What we need to say to people is actually what we do is by make all journalism more inclusive, more representative, meeting the needs of all communities. And that's how we fix a lot of the problems.
Andy, do you want to come in with a final point?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just do a really quick comment on the question around the Senedd Commission and the role of the Senedd, because I know they've done a lot of work in recent years about engagement. They have a particular priority around trying to increase voter turnout through the engagement work that they do. So all I'll really say is that it would be very odd to have a conversation about the design of a fund like this without involving the Senedd Commission directly, because I think the main role they would play with whatever then would get funded from this thing would be around access and making a really clear and easy path to getting the information about what happens in the Senedd for these journalists. And I noticed that just Ivan from Nation.com has mentioned in the chat room around, you know, the need to fund perhaps individual journalists who aren't tied to a particular platform. And I think that's really important. So the SenEd role could be, you know, enabling that just through direct support. Frankly, improving the website would go some way. If somebody uses a SenEd website fairly regularly, quite difficult to find the information what I want on it sometimes. So you would probably need to kind of approach it from the point of view of designing both sides of the bridge here, so that the SenEd, which is quite open with the information it makes available, making it available to the journalists funded through this fund would be my starting point on that specific question.
Amazing. We need to wrap up. I just wanted to say, Lucas, you may have if you have a burning three sentence point you wanted to bring in.
Really quickly, one thing that I forgot to mention on the funding is funding has got to be part of a funding mix. And I think one of the big benefits of the cables model is that by being a reader revenue model, that really makes us at every turn center the needs of communities and the people who are funding us. So I think if funding can facilitate that and help nourish and nurture that kind of funding, I think that kind of reader center model, not a transactional but a meaningful one in which communities are actually involved in the organization, is an essential part. We wouldn't want to rely on external funding. The mission is to have funding from people who actually want to support us.
Brilliant, thank you. Okay, thank you everyone so much. I'm just going to pass back to Auriel to close.
Brilliant, thanks very much indeed, Debs, and a really interesting discussion in the chat today. I want to thank our panelists for giving us their time, Emma Mees, Shirish Kulkarni, Lucas Batt, Andy Regan and Debs for doing some excellent chairing. Thank you too to very fair and open challenges, both to the IWA, Shirish, well noted, and thank you as a fellow 50-year-old, I take your point. And also I wanted just to acknowledge David Nicholson's challenge about why no NUJ people on the panel today. Very happy to have a follow-up conversation with you, David, about that. It's always an issue in terms of how you balance panels and the voices that you have on them. I want to just pick up on two quick things. I have gone beyond our 12 o'clock cutoff point. The thing, the words that stand out for me from today's conversation are trust, people powered, very definitely. The issues around the politics of the funding, the importance of reflecting the diversity in the communities that we all serve, with the point of equity being key to that. For us at the IWA, our mission is to support and strengthen and ensure a strong, confident democracy in Wales. So that is our ultimate goal. There are many different ways in which that plays out, and this is one of them, and a hugely important one. Emma, I loved hearing the example of the after schools club stuff, so thank you for sharing that with people too. But I thought Shirish's point about working with families is important as well, and cuts across so many of these issues around education. You've absolutely got to bring the parents along with you. Good challenges too to journalists about crowding out the misinformation with even better information too. So I think the thing that I come away with from today's conversation is it's on all of us, whatever role we play, in whatever shape or form, and doing our best isn't good enough anymore, and it won't be good enough. We've got to do more than our best. How we do that means working together in an open and inclusive and challenging conversation, and that's what we're aiming to provide here. So I just want to say thanks very much indeed to everybody for joining us. If you also want to receive early notifications of future IWA events, recording of all of our online sessions, do please join us as a member. You can find more about the BBC and Beyond project at bbcandbeyond.net, and the link is going to be in the chat. You can also play your own part in supporting an open, politically independent organisation at a crucial juncture for Wales, and it really is crucial. Really, Jochen Vaur, thank you very much indeed for attending. We have our last Rethinking Wales session before we break for the summer, so do please keep the morning of Thursday, the 8th of July, free. Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye.